all right, sir.
Better ask my nurse. My English is not good enough for me to know.
That daughter of mine seems to be knocking them cold rather before her time, doesn't she?
Knocking them cold? What does it mean?
It's just an expression, you know.
Luckily, if you didn't catch a death of cold.
Hello, Louis. Ooh. Good thing you didn't lose your head.
Sorry I upset you.
Don't mind. It was a very awkward moment.
Come along now. You've been here quite long enough.
Do you expect me to talk?
Hello and good evening and welcome to episode 244 of Do You Expect Us to Talk? I'm Becca and as always joined by my fellow co-hosts Chris and Dave. How are you both?
Good evening, folks.
Oh, good evening, everyone. I've just got back from my sun worship mass. It was quite good.
Did you wear nothing? Did you have any clothes on?
This occasion, yeah. I mean, the last place was a bit funny because like they closed down because apparently like the owners wanted to assassinate some sort of political person.
I think Chris. I think Chris got
something very weird.
And was going to go for proprietors and couldn't do it.
What if you didn't visit a dodgy dentist on the way in?
Were you hypnotised in 8 seconds as well?
Yeah.
Did your mind go completely blank?
After having a tooth that didn't need fixing, yeah.
Well, is it like added value? Did that guy wake up and he's like, "Hey, I've got an extra one, and it's really good."
I just wonder like how often do people go in sort of like, "Yeah, can I just have a filling?" Nothing wrong with it. I just want a filling.
I love that. It's like, well, we'll turn up and we'll just say I need complex treatment. Yeah, like a dentist would go,
please.
Well, they look fine, but I'll take your word for it.
I mean, if you've got the money, fair enough.
Does that work for everything? You know, you go into hospital, I think I need a heart bypass. It's like, have you had any of the tests? No.
Can I have a new hip?
let's freshen it up, though.
Can I have a new
hip?
This was
pre-NHS, wasn't it? This is pre-NHS, very...
So you're saying it's back in the days where you could get all manner of treatment for 5 shillings?
Bargain.
All right. Yeah. So tell us about tonight's film.
Tonight, we're skipping a few films ahead and we're going to go straight on to the 1934 original of The Man Who Knew Too Much, which this year, 2024, is celebrating its 90th anniversary.
Well, I hope the cast have a really good time at the reunion.
Well, skipping ahead to the Fab Facts, obviously one died recently and they were the last surviving cast member, so join us at the Fab Facts Fun Facts to find out who it was.
Without skipping too far ahead, why might this title be familiar to people, whether they've seen it or not?
So, is this why it's important? Okay, well obviously I think a lot of people will know it perhaps through its remake, 1950s remake with Doris Day and Jimmy Stewart. But this is, obviously this is the OG, this is the original. My argument would be that obviously people would count sort of typically The Lodger, for example, as the first Hitchcock movie, for example, that contains all the tropes. I would kind of argue that yes, it is. But also that I think that particular title, I mean, obviously Hitchcock would really hone his craft in the films to come. And then it'd probably be maybe too, he hopped over to America when, you know, and really sort of coined the term Hitchcockian as that subgenre. But I would kind of argue that that title would actually belong to like Blackmail, the previous film, and also this one as well, because we see a lot of the similar tropes, like obviously the man on the run, wrong man, MacGuffin, for example, sort of really cultured villains, Peter Lorre, for example, as well, kind of really sort of start to take shape here as well. And there's a lot of suspense, obviously, and this is a comedy as well, so Hitchcock trying to do all the genres. I know he was largely known for sort of like crime, thriller, suspense, but here he kind of shows he can kind of really do it all, I would say. It's a notable film, it's one of those really early ones, but it kind of is really, the Hitchcock kind of subgenre is really starting to take shape. That would be my argument as to why I'm including it on this.
So was this like kind of mixture of the comedy and the thriller, was that that specifically Hitchcock at this time, or was this kind of what films were like?
Is he doing something fresh?
Yeah, he's trying to do pretty much, you know, he's kind of known for, obviously, in the modern era, he's sort of known for any sort of suspense and sort of crime thrillers, that sort of thing. But I think at this time, he was literally trying all genres, really, to kind of see what fits. And also, so like, for example, I think it's the only musical he's done, Waltzes from Vienna, that wasn't a big hit so much. Whereas from here on, was certainly for our next film, The 39 Steps, that was kind of one that kind of brought him more traction, more kind of critical acclaim, as that were. So that kind of was one of those really early films that enabled him to go to America and eventually work with Selznick. But I think here, yeah, I was just trying lots of different things. There's a couple of quotes that I just like to share. They're on the, for those lucky listeners in the US, if they've got this release on Criterion Disc, which is really, really, really nice. There's an interview with director Guillermo del Toro about this movie, which he says for him, this is one of the first films where Hitchcock's style really flourishes organically within the story. For del Toro, this film blends the two sides of Hitchcock's personality, the master of suspense, but it also showcases his skills as a comedic director. So like, for example, there's a scene where Clive, the sort of comic foil character, sneezes whilst he's being led away by two policemen. And also the chair fight scene, which is unintentionally hilarious. But also, like, along with drama and suspense and thriller genres, they require so much control of timing, but equally so does comedy. And del Toro kind of argues that Hitchcock's propensity to find humour in the darkness of places, obviously he's known for black comedy, just to give Psycho as an example, it's probably the pitchest black comedy ever. And again, that film in itself just spans so many genres. But del Toro views it as like the first modern Hitchcock movie, where he shows that you can't just do one genre, he's really got to do it all. And he kind of really does. So it's like drama, suspense, thriller, crime.
Bit of horror
as well, definitely. And also comedy as well. Mm-hmm. But I, just for me personally, I would kind of argue that, I mean, yes, you can do black comedy, but when he tries to do like out and up comedy, I don't think it's successful. I don't think it really works.
Not from what I've seen, but like, I deny.
That's just my own personal opinion. I'm probably wrong.
I think a good example for me, and I've got nowhere near your knowledge on Hitchcock, I might by the end of this, but there's several I've not even seen. But if I think of a film that would define what I mean by him being funny, is I think Rope is blackly funny as hell.
Yes.
Totally. And yet, no one would ever say, oh, that's comedic. But when you watch it and you realise what they do, what they're doing, what they're hiding, what they know, the attempt to have ordinary conversations but kind of hint at what they've done, that's really blackly comedic in my opinion. And he can do that. North by Northwest, I think, has some comedic elements.
Yeah, some darkly comic moments. I went to go and see, like, at the moment, the Prince Charles have a season on. I managed to catch Notorious, and also recently, what did I go and see? Yeah, Rope was a good example. Notorious, for example. Strangers on a Train was another one. And again, they're not out and out comedies, but they do have, you know, really darkly comic moments. One audience member literally laughed out loud. And that could be kind of like a, you know, you can learn new things and think, oh, okay, that's quite a comic moment, or perhaps something that you didn't think was funny, but perhaps is.
I think I'd have probably got more from watching this with an audience, and I'll probably explain that as we go through it. You just mentioned, putting this in his sort of timeline. So we've skipped a few films, because if you remember, the last film we did was 1929. We're now up to 1934. Given when films are made, he's probably about 34 when he's making this, because he's born in 1899, but in August. So he's about 34 at this point. Obviously, we're properly in sound now, rather than the sort of hybrid version we got last week. But you mentioned Selznick. So best explain that then. So what drew him, and we'll talk about this more in future weeks, but in brief, we're in 1934. By 1940... he will be in America, and you mentioned Selznick. Can you explain that and what drew him to his... who's Selznick and what drew him to his view?
Actually, if that's okay with you, I was going to save that bit of information for when we do actually come to review Rebecca in 1940.
Okay.
If that's all right, not to kind of keep you in suspense that too much, but just to be very lazy.
I guess what I was trying to get at is how far is this from the things that would have drawn him to his attention. But we can certainly cover that, Rebecca, if you like.
Let me just draw up my list a moment. Hold on. I have a list of the films that I would like to cover in this series. Please bear with me, listeners, whilst I open up that list. There we go. So, yeah, like in this series, like I said in the very first episode when we started this series, obviously I don't... even though this is kind of like my baby, as it were, and thanks to Chris and Dave for indulging me and finally getting me to do this and get out of my system.
God, I mean, I'm made to watch Hitchcock films, jeez.
Well, you know, we can get on to the good stuff. Get this out of the way.
Yeah, I mean, you could have gone, you know what, I really want to do a McGee season, or like...
Series.
See, I'd happily do a McGee season as long as we were all on the same page that we were going to rip the piss. But can you imagine if you thought of McGee, what you think of Hitchcock, and we've got to take it dead seriously because it's something you care about. Quality. Where they're going, I can see that's quite artistic.
I mean, there are like the Zack Snyder fanatics. I mean,
well, there are, yes. Well, everything's relative, don't they? I mean, you know, some people might. Like Zack Snyder might be their favourite director, or McGee even might be their favourite director. Or...
I've no problem with that. It's when I see them on Twitter claiming that people like myself just don't understand it, and I'm thinking, fucking hell, well, all right, yeah, I'm not very silly, literate, or intelligent, that's fine.
Well, it's one of those, you know, it's to each their own, really, isn't it? I mean, there are going to be people who don't like Hitchcock or whatever, you know, it's very old-fashioned, obviously probably cancelled by now, not very PC, that sort of thing. And it's more like a legacy, sort of, for example. I mean, hugely influential, but nonetheless a legacy. But that's fine. That's fair enough.
You were looking at the list.
I'm going back to my list. Basically, yeah, I started this series. Obviously, I don't want to do all of his films. There are other podcasts for that. I will cite you towards Good Evening Pod and also Hitch Pod. But what I've done is I've tried to kind of pick some ones that are cultural relevance. So like I've gone, for example, The Lodger, which is probably the most well-known of his early films, Downhill, purely because of its themes, and also it's another Ivan Novello, and it's very underseen, so I'd like to direct you in that direction. I'd like to direct you towards that film anyway.
Rope, because we're all heavily into bondage, that sort of thing.
Yes, this is and taxi dancing, you know. So like, for example, I've decided to skip over films that perhaps are lesser known. So, like, between Downhill and Blackmail, I've skipped out about four or five films. I've gone for Blackmail, obviously, because it's technically important, being the first talkie. But then I've gone from this one and skipped out another sort of five or six films. Like, I've, you know, excluded, like, Number 17, for example, Murder! Exclamation mark, skipped out, and also Waltzes from Vienna, which I just mentioned. But I've tried to pick out certain films that are perhaps culturally important or perhaps more well-known as well. But also there's a few where I just happen to like them, like Young and Innocent, for example. I could have left that by the wayside. But I think the performances in it are really, really strong. And it's a good example of that Hitchcockian subgenre really starting to take shape. From Lady Vanishes and Jamaica Inn, for example, which I know, Dave, you wanted to cover those two, especially Jamaica Inn being geographically relevant to yourself.
It's up the road, that's all. I'm just curious as to... Because I went in there, and just very quickly, and I'll talk more about this in a couple of weeks' time when we do it, but the thing is, I've physically been there, and, of course, it's a mixture of a sort of restaurant, bar, farm shop, and sort of inn and... tourist shop under the same roof, so you can walk in and buy Daphne du Maurier books and things like that, and Poldark and God knows what else. And the other side, it's like a farm shop because of where we are, and it's just like, okay, this has a cultural relevance. Let's see what that's about.
Yeah.
Rather than just know something was made about it.
Yes,
As I am in sort of Poldark country and never even seen or read it, it helps to have seen it so you actually know why it's famous for that. So that's why I want to do Jamaica Inn, although otherwise, if it wasn't for that, if I was living anywhere else in the country, I wouldn't have been that bothered, and we could have like skipped to Rebecca. But yeah, we will do it. So yeah, in short, really, you've picked this because sort of it's an early proper talkie. It gets remade later, and it's starting to look like the filmmaker that comes to Hollywood's attention. Would that be fair?
I would kind of argue that, yeah, definitely. That's certainly from my perspective as well. And I'm sure there's kind of been other sort of critical readings on it, for example, as well. But yeah, I would say my sort of my argument would be that even though sort of like The Lodger gets called like the first Hitchcock movie, it probably was. I would kind of argue that, as we know, it certainly is a sub-genre. It kind of starts to take shape probably Blackmail in this movie as well. But again, a lot of people will know it through the remake, the Jimmy Stewart remake, which is quite famous. When we come to it, I'll be singing all the praises of Doris Day, in case there are.
Doris Day was not literally, but she, as you'll see when we get to it, she was ageless. I don't think she was super young when she made that film, you know, was she?
No, but she is timeless. And yeah, she's a legend. Timeless. Yeah. Obviously, it does go
on. I didn't realise there was two. Well, I wouldn't say a remake, because it's not actually a remake when I've looked it up. It's a complete different story, isn't it? Or more or less.
Sort of. I mean, you've still got the kidnapped child. You've still got the kidnapped child, and you've still got the sort of stakes bigger than all of that, and you've still got like set pieces at the Albert Hall. So I haven't seen it for a long time, but it looked like similar to me. But then in a few weeks' time when we watch it and I read back, I'll be, yeah, actually it was quite different.
Yeah, I mean, they are like broadly similar, but there are going to be sort of big differences as well. But again, it's one of those things. I think that's because it's obviously colour, it's more starry. Obviously, this film had Peter Lorre, but it was quite early on in his career. Like, obviously, he was well known in his native country, but then obviously came over here.
Hungarian.
Obviously, with the, sort of like Czech, German, Bulgarian, definitely. But then obviously, the remake's got, Doris Day, Jimmy Stewart. It's in glorious Technicolor.
It's a beautiful looking film.
Really nice. Yeah, the
most of his films were restored in the late 90s, a bit like Bond, very similar sort of time.
Yes,
I think Bond was a little afterwards, like, but I remember having a copy of, say, Vertigo, for example, that I think was restored in 99, and all of that era of his films just look fantastic.
And a lot of his films they recently put out, was it end of last year, 4K Blu-ray box set, haven't they, as well, so that they'll look absolutely stunning.
Yeah, if I was still buying physical media, I'd probably have had that. But I mean, I'll have the Masterpiece collection, but we'll get to that. Chris, what did you make of this? Because obviously it's your first time, well, it's my first time seeing it as well, but I'm asking the question. What did you get? How did you get on with this?
I got on it pretty well, actually. I think, you know, we touched upon like sort of the mixture of the humour and the comedy, and I found that a bit disorientated. It didn't feel... It didn't quite sort of gel together. Now, I'm not sure, again, I don't know, is it me looking back to a film that's...
90 years old.
Yeah.
It is like, 90 years old, I find it a bit disorienting as well, so don't worry about that.
No, yeah, well, you know, that's just it. It's like, you know, it's one of the things where, like, well, if I have a major criticism, it's probably that, but then would that be fair to call it a criticism? You know, when you that's why I was asking, like, was a lot of films like this at the time, was this kind of like the thing to do? Not that any of the humour was actually bad. I actually some of it was thought was quite funny, but it just felt a bit a bit disorientated, a bit random. Do you know what I mean? And which was kind of unexpected. But apart from that, yeah, I quite liked it. Peter Lorre. I'm gonna say something that's really like everyone's said this before, but you know, why couldn't he be actual, you know, a Bond villain? Like, you know, it's.
Well,
it's
he was.
Like,
he was Le Chiffre in.
Well, and Royale, and wasn't he? And that's the thing. Like,
he died in 1964. Are you talking? Oh, you're talking about the climax. Yes, he was.
Yeah,
it's climax.
I was thinking of Orson Welles in the thing. Sorry, yes, he was. He was in the TV with Card Sense Jimmy Bond. Yes, he was.
And that's the thing, is like, you know, because now I've actually, you know, read Casino Royale, you know, description of the chief, it's him down to a T. It's like, oh, he's perfect.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's missed opportunity, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Blows your mind that he's probably 29 filming this.
It's crazy, isn't it? It really is crazy.
He has that sort of odd look, though, doesn't he? That kind of like, you know, he kind of looks like that sort of half schoolboy, half full grown man kind of look, but a bit off. But then he has like a charm, like there is a sort of a charm / menace to him as well, which is like everything about him is just so unique, but sort of kind of off putting.
Yeah, really as weird. I say, you know. This will be some of the things he's had influences on, to be fair. So he almost literally is, but he's like a walking cartoon character.
You can easily see why, like, he was so easily parodied in some, like, the Warner Brothers cartoons and that, for example.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's almost like, say, if, you know, took like, say, Ralph from The Simpsons, but made him intelligent and sinister.
Yeah, there's sort of like almost childlike quality, isn't there? Definitely.
Yeah, but he could play anything, because there was a couple of times in the film he threw a look, and he looked like a teenager, and other times I thought he looked about 50. You just can't. From scene to scene, there's a strange amount of range in him. You've got to remember he's not working in his native language. He was born in sort of Hungary, and then he sort of worked on the stage and then film in Berlin. So yeah, this is.
I think this is probably one of his first English language films, I think, because he had to learn his lines. He did a bit of a Gert Fröbe and Goldfinger. He had to sort of learn his lines, like, and speak them phonetically almost.
Mm. He left because he's Jewish. So obviously Adolf Hitler comes to power.
Yeah, he's escaped persecution.
Yeah, sort of before it happened, but he knew what was coming. Yeah, so you know, as we got with the sort of thing you couldn't get away with. Now he even played like a Japanese detective in things, because he just has this malleability of look. I do remember him for the Maltese Falcon.
Yeah, check that out.
Yeah,
Casablanca as well is a famous role of his.
Casablanca as well, obviously.
The classic Fritz Lang movie. If you haven't seen that, check it out. Oh my gosh,
I haven't seen it actually.
It's amazing. Obviously, he plays quite a dodgy role, but yeah, that's quite interesting. If you watch that, and then that'll be relevant to when we come to do another film later on. So
yeah, so you've gone pretty well with it, Chris.
Yeah, I'd say so. I thought the ending kind of dragged a little bit, but those sort of niddles aside, it's like what I've said on previous episodes. It's like I feel a bit like I'm not quite in my comfort zone, because, you know, I feel like I'm critiquing a film that's like nearly 190 years old, and
no, it's not 190 years old.
No, 100/90 years old.
Oh, all right, I get it. Sorry, you know, I was going to say it weren't made in 1834.
That'd be amazing.
And I feel sometimes like, am I being a bit too? Do are my criticisms a tad unfair? You know, I
don't think this is a singular point, because it's a bit like, it wasn't like The Jazz Singer was released and then everything was sound from the following morning. But obviously, I've done. So, when we start talking about talkies and that, I suddenly become a lot more comfortable knowing what the standard is meant to be when we get into like the 40s. I've seen so many films from 1940 onwards that, like, if I watch a film from 1942 and it hits a certain standard, I go, well, or it's not very good. I don't feel like I'm beating up films of that era, because I'm much more comfortable with what films of that era should be like. But you don't have to go much before that. And I've only just thought of it, so it's kind of arbitrary. But off the top of my head, much before about 1940, I'm a lot less comfortable with, well, what was the standard meant to be? In terms of how I got on with it, again, I'm a bit like Chris. I don't want to beat up on something, because I kind of enjoyed it just fine. But, I mean, even from the great Hitchcock era, with the handful of stars like a Cary Grant or a Jimmy Stewart that would have been famous in any era just for their likability and screen manner. But there's no doubt people laugh at things like method acting. But you go to that sort of Brando onwards era, and certainly the De Niro era, and acting standards just go through the roof. And so when they do, there's little arguing about it. You can love all these old classics, but you watch something like this and it's stagey and stilted as fuck, the acting. And I'm not really having a go at it. It was the standard of the time. We are only 7 or 8 years on from talkies even starting. And it's a quantum leap on from what we had last week in terms of how they're behaving in front of a camera. I think the most negative things I can say about this film, before I do start being relatively kind to it, is I will point out the scene when we get there, but I didn't actually know it was meant to be comedic till fairly late in the film. So I was laughing at it, not with it. And Chris is right that we get what looks like it's going to be the sort of denouement. And then it goes on to another like action sequence shootout type thing, which is like really, really poorly staged. Because again, they don't have the props they've got now. They're not used to faking gunplay, and plus you've got an American British director anyway, and guns have never really been a thing here. So I struggled with elements of it. There were bits of it that when I laughed at them, I didn't know if it was because the film was meant to be funny or it just wasn't very well thought through, or it was the naivety of the time. But I liked elements of it. I thought Edna Best was really good in it. I don't know what she went on to do in terms of how big a star she was. I've not heard of her before. That's not to say I haven't seen her in stuff, because I've seen a lot of films from this era, but I can't place her. I don't know if I know her from anything else, but I really, really liked her in this. I thought the plot unfolded just fine. I thought it was a little bit like all of the films from this era. I remember thinking, particularly when we were at that sort of cult church thing that Chris named a little while ago, I remember thinking, like, we complain about films being too long, but I'm kind of glad they got longer than this, because they don't know how to pace things. That's going to be a regular complaint with some of these early films, but bits drag, and it happened last week with Blackmail, that it takes you an hour to get to the blackmail, and then you have to race through the last bit, and it's almost like they don't know how to pace something that isn't, I don't know, a play or something. And it's just an immature art form. But by and large, I enjoyed it. I'll point to the things I have problems with when I get to them. Most of them will be the age of the film. Some of it will be, I think Becker's hit the nail on the head, actually. When it's black comedy, you can do it. But when it's overtly comedic, you can't even always spot it's comedy. So I didn't even know I was supposed to be laughing with it. But there are shots I really love in it. And there have been in every single Hitchcock film that I go, that's a bit ahead of its time. And it's nothing that wow now, but it's something that, like in any other films I've seen pre sort of 1950, I never saw that before. You go and watch, to pick a silly example without giving you the scene, but if you go and watch the original 1958 version of The Fly, unlike the Jeff Goldblum version where he slowly sort of morphs into some hybrid of man and fly, this is literally a fly taking the human head of the person, and the person ended up with a big fly's head, which sounds funnier than it is, because I actually remember finding it a bit unsettling when I watched it, even though I can't honestly say it was scary. But there's a bit where she whips he's wearing, like, the human version of him with the fly's head is wearing something over his head to hide it from his wife. And eventually she takes it off and you get the shot from him. It's from his eyes, and because they've got so many eyes, they're just seeing loads of him. And you wouldn't think anything of that now, but it would have been so innovative at the time. And I think what I'm going a long way around saying is every Hitchcock film I've seen so far has had something like that, where I go, oh, they wouldn't have known to do that before, they actually just did it. So lots of positives to say about it. It doesn't touch the remake, because it's not so different from memory, because I've seen it for a long time. There's not so much different that you can't link the two and go, how do they compare? It's not like two completely different films with the same title. There are huge similarities. The remake's a lot better, but even then, when we get to it, again from memory, it wasn't my favourite of his sort of 1950s work either. So, yeah, we're going in the right direction, but it's still just before an era I'm very comfortable critiquing. It's almost like you drop from... I can do it with silent films because I kind of know what to expect now from experience. And then there's early talkies, and then you finally get to that sort of 1940s era and I'm okay again. So that's it for me for a minute for opening thoughts. Becca?
I'm glad to be taking you on that journey. Hopefully it's not too bumpy.
It's not bumpy at all, but it just shows you that you never stop learning. I mean, hundreds, if not, well, tens of thousands of films are made every year, and you're only going to see a few hundred of those, even if you're busy at the cinema. But your education is never complete, and this just shows me, yeah, the 1930s, more than the silent era, is an era I don't really know how to... I will critique it, but it comes with caveats that, like, well, I thought this, but is it the time? Is it this? Is it that? So, yeah, it's not an era I know much about, and hence... I think, but we are, like I say, we're going in the right direction. We're getting closer to an era I understand.
No, definitely. Well, I'm pretty much the same. I mean, I'm probably like without blowing my own trumpet, it's kind of, I'm probably the biggest fan out of all y'all's, out of you two, out of us three even.
I'm a fan of like an 8 to 10 year period, basically. Yeah, whereas you know a lot of it, yeah.
Well, it's one of those, like, you probably get to film sort of Rear Window, Vertigo, Psycho, for example. That's probably like the best thing. North by Northwest, for example.
Yeah, that's my era.
There's like four or five film run that are kind of like, you know, they're best known, that are probably like the most influential, and that sort of thing. But it's quite good to kind of like explore like the gems of those ideas, that kind of like, you know, to explore like how he got that way, basically, kind of what happened in terms of career and that sort of thing. And we turned like with this film as well, just having a quick look at on the in terms of like how it was received and things like that. There's a thing from an old BFI page. It says, this film was kind of important and kind of it drove him more towards the crime genre, for example. Like he made Horses from Vienna, which was an epic failure, and then kind of decided to make this film next. Money Knew Too Much, it was a spectacular success, rescuing Hitchcock from a difficult period in which he struggled to find the right project to match his talent. Afterwards, he increasingly associated himself with the crime genre. And so again, that would kind of almost sort of cement him as that kind of like sort of prime thriller sort of thing. So I think that's probably why this film is certainly significant in terms of the timeline. Not the other films aren't so much, but they're just perhaps, or certainly what I would deem to be better examples. Other sort of critics might say yes or no. But yeah, even, you know, I'm probably like the biggest fan out of all three of us. There are still things that I don't know. And there's still quite a few films that I haven't seen. Like, for example, like Marnie, I'm not that big a fan of. I mean, Sean Connery's brilliant in it. I'm so Stevie Hedren. But I find
Sean Connery in that film might be the most pitch-perfect casting of a film ever, given what we know of Sean Connery.
Well, exactly. Yeah. This is it. I mean, I struggle with a lot of the themes of it. It's very beautifully shot, really well shot, and very psychologically complex.
It's less a Hitchcock from that era, but it's really good.
Yeah, that's it, for example. And then, you know, as we go on, I've literally just included, obviously, Frenzy was his triumphant return to England in the 70s.
I haven't seen it. Oh, we talked about that because you were telling me I've missed out on nudity.
Well, I think, again, that's quite interesting. I mean, a lot of people might hate it because of the sexism, because of the nudity. But I would argue it's not sexist.
But don't you think that's a very good sign of how well we all know each other now? Because if this was 10 years ago, you'd have gone, oh, you got to see it, Dave, because it's got this in it and that in it and the other in it, right? Now, I just go and see it. You go, there's tits in it, Dave. And you just go like, yeah.
It's got boobs.
Yeah, you just go, boobs, Dave. And I go, oh, yeah, I see that now.
Well, again, because obviously we had, going through the 60s and everything, you had obviously carry-ons, for example, obviously you had Bond and everything. So moving away to kind of like more permissive society, for sure.
Yeah.
But again, like, I would argue that's quite groundbreaking, not for Miss of Society, but the film is quite groundbreaking, because you didn't have so much nudity in that at the time as well.
And it would stand out more, yeah, absolutely.
But it would, and certainly like, because it deals with like a serial killer, basically, and it kind of almost preempts like rolling news, because you know that's sort of the spoiler, but that sort of crime perhaps wasn't as prevalent as it is now, unfortunately. But then like I would say, like, again, like Family Plot, for example, like the last film that he made before passing away in 1980, is not one I've seen very often. And like, for example, there's a period kind of like mid-60s, I think he made a couple of kind of spy thrillers, which I do find a bit boring.
Torn Curtain.
Yeah, Torn Curtain. And then, I mean, it's... I think it's really important, and it does kind of go into that kind of, it slides into that kind of Euro spy genre, again, which is popular at the time due to Bond. I mean, you know, there's some films that I do love, some films that I don't enjoy so much.
So he effectively helps set the template for Bond and then makes a film heavily derivative of the genre.
Pretty much. Yeah, he made North by Northwest. And then...
joking aside, all of these things actually do feed in that, I mean, joking aside, because I've never literally gone and watched a film because there's boobs in it. There has to be at least some markers. But like, all joking aside, when we talked about the 80s and we talked about RoboCop, there was a period in the 80s where it got so permissive that they realised they could put a load of sex and violence, or at least nudity and violence in things, and they did, and it was being crammed in absolutely everywhere. and it's just pointless. And I'm sort of with Quentin Tarantino on it, actually, because Quentin Tarantino said something like, he was asked why there's never any sex or nudity in his films, and he said, you just don't need it. It's hugely distracting, and it never has anything to do with the plot. And when actresses say, oh, I don't mind doing sex scenes if it's integral, well, I'm sorry, unless you're making The Dreamers, it fucking isn't. So I generally, like, if I want to see that, go and watch fucking porn. And unless it's literally an erotic thriller, it tends to be a distraction. But
doing a film about erotic thriller.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. I mean, you can't not have it in Boogie Nights. I get that. But it's nothing to do with being prudish at all. It quite the opposite. It's more the fact that it's actively distracting from the film to actually slam that in where you don't need it. I remember watching a film with Christopher Lambert years ago. I think it was with Diane Lane. It was called Night Moves. And after about 20 minutes of the film, there was just this sex scene and it finished. And I was watching it with my dad and he turned to me and he said, why was that there? And I said, and I remember I was about 14 at the time. I said, I think they needed to sell the film. And that's kind of how I think about it. But my point is that when you don't have much of that stuff in film, in film generally, suddenly it hits a lot harder when you use it.
No, that's it. Yeah, sometimes it can be used like for shock value as well. I think when it comes to Frenzy, I think that's probably one... It might have, I'm not quite sure, I need to double check, but it might have like a 15 or an 18 rating even, currently here in the UK. I'll need to double check, find out which one it is. But I think because of the nature of it as well, sometimes it's used to shock, obviously, because Hitch does kind of like provoke quite a little bit because, you know, because he can, he really does like to push that envelope, as he's done also technologically. And I like, for example, Psycho has like the first scene, there's no nudity involved, or you think there's no nudity, you see a side boob.
On the remake, you see Anish's butthole.
You see, yeah, you do. You see, whether you want to or not. Yeah. But likewise, like conversely, but yeah, like for example, so like, you know, some scenes in Frenzy where it might be a bit gratuitous. I mean, it's nothing by modern standards, for example. But there's some scenes where, like, especially in early 70s, it might seem a bit gratuitous. But also, there's one scene where it is necessary to the plot, for example, just. As a potato sack involved, I won't say any more. Spoiler alert.
Films where these things are integral to the plot. You cannot film a PG-13 or a PG version of Basic Instinct. I get it, but as I say,
yeah, we're chopping out all the good bits.
You have to think about how you use it if you're going to use it.
Yeah, otherwise,
you are screaming to the audience, we'd like some teenage boys to watch this.
That's it, definitely. It's a bit like Chekhov's gun, like we do have in this film, for example. It's got to be absolutely necessary. It's got to be in there for, you know, for a reason.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you an example recently. Scarlett Johansson has a very short nude scene in the latest Wes Anderson film. No fucking need for it whatsoever. Not unhappy to see any of that, but you go, why? Yeah, that's my point.
No, yeah, it was just a quick point in terms of like the nudity. Do you think sometimes it's a bit of a weird actor thing where it's like they have to show that they are willing to do it for the right type of people, the right framing, but you know what I mean, in that kind of weird kind of validation,
yeah,
thing.
They can do it, I guess.
It's that like, oh, I'm willing to do it if it's artistic, but they kind of like, it's not, it
sometimes it is, but very rarely is my point.
Yeah,
that's my point. But I make it sound like I don't mind seeing nudity. But yeah. It's really odd in a lot of films that it's in.
Yeah, you know, but so yeah, some actors and actresses perhaps, yeah, might like to do it just because like they can.
That
or
said,
they
I
can
ran
do
to
it
what I literally sprinted. It could be like a weird
act of vanity thing. Do you know what I mean? It could be like a bit of a.
Oh, okay. Like, yeah, probably.
Like, you know, obviously not in the way. Oh, I'm not gonna go topless or nude for anything, but for on certain films on certain times.
Do you remember George and Lynn? Do you remember George and Lynn? Right? George and Lynn was a little comic strip. I think it was in the Sun newspaper. And it was only 3 or 4 panels. And they were
I don't
always,
think I've ever heard of it.
They were always naked. Look up George and Lynn, right? This is in the Sun newspaper. This is fucking like mainstream. I'm not saying about go and look at Razzle or something, right? And it would be a comic strip where they'd be like nude. They were a couple. They were a married couple who were in love.
Right until 2010.
And,
I've never heard of this.
And she would
before.
Usually be topless, right? And they'd be chatting to each other, but like they'd be having a barbecue or chatting about a book they were reading. That's the plot of the plot. It's only 3 panels, but the plot of this little mini situation has nothing to do with them being naked. And I just thought, like, what next? Is she going to finger herself while talking about a Mary Berry recipe?
This is so weird. Okay, the strip focus on the titular married couple, George and Lindsay, like who live in a nice house in the suburbs of Southwest London. George is a breadwinner working in what appeared to be property law, so his exact job was never mentioned, and then spent a day shopping, socialising and sunbathing. The couple had no children, enjoyed life of holidays, fine dinners, and incredibly bad jokes, mostly by Lynn. Lynn had a relaxed attitude to nudity and was frequently shown topless or naked, which George and many of the son's readers did not mind at all. I've never seen that before. That's hilarious.
I just remember laughing about it. I remember, like, somebody, I was on a trip somewhere, and somebody had the Sun newspaper, which I'm not fond of, but I was a lot younger than anyway. And I looked, and I remember looking at it for something, and it was probably literally sport. It's like I'd been some sport the previous day. And I read it, and I started having a flick through, and I got to George and Lynn, which I was perfectly aware of. I'm not claiming I'd never seen this newspaper. But I got to that, and I remember there was a person on this coach. We were off to see universities or something. And I remember looking at him, I said, look at this strip here. And I said, I said, three panels, they're completely naked, yeah? I said, what has that scenario got to do with them being naked at all, right? It's basically like an Eva Green film or something. But yeah.
What, Casino Royale?
Yeah, absolutely. No, but like, was it? Well, the second Sin City film, she's completely naked in most of that. And there's absolutely no reason to be. But in that situation, I gave it a pass. That was all right.
I think that's, that, again, with Sin City, those movies, that is quite gratuitous as well, isn't it? I mean, the way it's kind of shot, the way it's framed, that kind of comic-style black and white imagery as well. But, again, it's quite gratuitous, along with, like, the violence. Gratuitous sex and violence. But, yeah, I think as long as it's, you know, as long as it's done well, I guess, compared to this film, which has no nudity in it.
Which is disappointing. No.
Which is shocking. Compared to, like, Blackmail, which had some nudity.
It's not the existence of it. It's not the offence of it. There's no problem with any of these things. I like plenty of films that have a ton of nudity in them. Mm. I just think there's an enormous amount of films where you go, why did they even bother?
Yeah,
and you just go, and then your mind gets drawn
Love
out
actually
of
the
film.
Is the one that sticks out to me the most.
Your mind gets drawn out of it thinking, ah, they were trying to market it. And then suddenly
a marketing
I'm thinking,
tool, doesn't it?
Almost? I'm watching product. And I'm thinking, I've never thought that watching Pornhub, which makes which makes Pornhub more artistically pure, in my opinion. Becca, thoughts?
I'm sorry, I can't offer you any thoughts on Pornhub, really? Unfortunately.
You disengage your brain when you're watching it then, yeah?
Although, I mean, this example, I mean, it would be quite handy, because when we come to do Psycho, for example, unfortunately, I will make you watch Creeping Tom, which, yeah, again, deals with, I mean, there's...
I think I've seen it, you know.
No nudity. Well, it's one nude scene, but it's literally blinking and you miss it.
No, I think I have a feeling, because I had, not permissive, but like, when I was staying with my grandparents, sometimes they'd watch a film of an evening that was just on TV. And whilst they wouldn't deliberately expose me to anything, if there happened to be a brief shot of something, they wouldn't particularly panic. And if the film is what I think it is, and the shot is what I think it is, then I've seen it, but not in like 40 years.
Okay, that'll be interesting to find out what it is. But yeah, no, it's just an example of where, like, it's used like as a suggestion, but it's literally blinking you miss it. But it's also the first example of a nude scene in a British film, which again is groundbreaking. But I got a shoehorn in that reference wherever I go.
2 years after the French first had it, you had Les Amants, the lovers.
Yeah, you did, definitely. And
which I totally watched.
The Michael Parr caught up about 2 years later, so. We're a little bit behind in terms of...
A little bit. Only a couple of years, though. I thought it'd be much, much longer, given the different attitudes.
Especially, like, in Europe as well. I mean, we'll elaborate more on this point when we come to it, but especially kind of, like, especially within law at Europe at the time, they were kind of getting more and more permissive, whereas in Britain, kind of, things were really tightening up. The Obscenity Act, ideally, something along that line, so it's kind of, we were really sort of clamping down, whereas in Europe... it was fine. It was all good.
Marlon Brando was arrested on an obscenity charge for Last Tango in Paris with Bertolucci.
Yes.
So not everywhere was the same.
No, not tarring all with the same brush, but just in general. And there was
that
trend.
Just so we don't talk about nudity all night when we're reviewing a film that doesn't have any. the other point Becca made that resonated with me, she was saying about how this is not the first Hitchcock film, but she said you can feel that he's had a failure and gone to this sort of thriller thing, and that sort of defines what he becomes thereafter. And I'm thinking, there's something to that, because we've watched films in the last 2 or 3 weeks where I've gone, that don't feel very Hitchcock. Now, that isn't always about quality, because if someone who'd never heard of Martin Scorsese said to me, show me a Martin Scorsese film, even if it was my favourite, I probably wouldn't show them Hugo. Do you know what I mean? It's what are they best known for?
Yeah.
And so you'd
probably be like Raging Bull or...
Yeah, you would pick something,
Taxi Driver, something like that.
Something a bit rawer, and possibly Mob, but not necessarily. And yeah, you wouldn't even necessarily show him, say, The King of Comedy, because that's actually a bit lighter, even though it's still
dark. Somebody said show you a Bond film, it perhaps might not be No Time to Die.
So Scorsese's such a hard filmmaker to sort of like give a general recommendation for, because he's so versatile. Like, I feel like
you would go fairly hard hitting and fairly R rated, wouldn't you? If you would just show somebody one thing as an example,
we would like a De Niro gangster film, right?
Yeah, okay. We wouldn't necessarily agree on the same example, because you go, well, when's he at his peak? Would I go for Mean Streets? Would I go for Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Goodfellas? Would I go newer with The Departed? You could pick loads of examples, but I'm saying that he's done some great films that wouldn't immediately make you think of him.
Mm.
And Killers of the Flower Moon is one of them.
Well, I mean, even like, it's probably a good few years now, it's probably 10 years old now, but Wolf of Wall Street, I mean, how old was Scorsese when that came out? I mean, but that film feels contemporary, it feels like that's a new up-and-coming filmmaker. That's a new, exciting filmmaker.
It's still quite fresh, isn't it?
And it's like, Scorsese, like, you know, vintage.
There's a world where Adam McKay did. I'm not relating their level of talent, by the way, but I'm saying in style. There's a world where Adam McKay doesn't go away and start making The Big Short and stuff like that. He goes in a different direction and makes something more along those lines. Yeah, it could definitely be a much, much younger filmmaker. Definitely. And it hasn't aged a day. I watched it. I reviewed it late last year. They did like a home release of it, and it's not aged a day.
Yeah, it's still fresh.
Mm. And then he does films like Silence, like completely different, but
great. Kundun. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, they're kind of more like tender, like more arty, for example. That are perhaps not known for the kind of like violent thrillers that he's known for.
Hugo is just a boy, and remember, you know, you can see that the love of cinema in it, but it's not a very Scorsese film apart from that.
No, that's probably got more in common you know, his love for Paolo Pressburger, for example, than, yeah, because Scorsese is kind of like, he's a real proponent of cinema as well and film restoration. So that's probably a callback to that era of him rather than the Taxi Drivers or Raging Bulls, or for example.
So, yeah, I think there's something in what you're saying. I think that although we've talked around the houses, I can sort of see why you would pick this as, well, this is what he becomes. This is what he does more of than anything else.
Well, it takes a while, I think. We're still not there just yet, but we're kind of getting there. I think probably 75%, for example. Mm. I would kind of pick this one as kind of, it has those tropes, or the beginnings of them. You know, you've got kind of like the MacGuffin, you've got the wrong man, men on the run, you've got that kind of like charming educated villain, this is it, definitely. And you've got these sort of caricatures and the sort of tropes which will pop up time and time again throughout the rest of the film. And again, it's even though it is a comedy as well, it is kind of mainly sort of like a thriller, suspense, crying.
I mean, my mind, because again, I know fewer of these films, but it also went to something like North by Northwest, where a quite unprepossessing person, or in this case, couple, are at the centre much of something they don't understand, much, much bigger than themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's that kind of thing which we'll see again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. And also, you've kind of got that, you know, as another reference to Psycho, for example, as well, you've kind of got like the man who knew too much, the title of the film, is actually killed off like in the first, what, 5-10 minutes, which is something that kind of anticipates Psycho many years ahead of its time.
Absolutely.
So you've kind of got that false protagonist who's whisked away from you, shockingly. But I don't think, obviously, it's not as effective here because he's perhaps not that familiar to it, certainly modern day audiences. Certainly not to me, unfortunately, I'm sorry. And, you know, it doesn't have that much impact time. Because when, you know, talking about like the man who knew too much, who was that man? Well, it was obviously, it was a skier, you know, at the start. But you don't spend that much time with him, you know, so you're not that invested. But nonetheless, it's still a very early example of that trope. And as you mentioned, Dave, yeah, you've kind of got that innocent couple on the run, maybe not on the run, caught up in something that's a lot, you know, a lot bigger than themselves, which is a trope and something we'll see time and time again. So yeah, totally.
So yeah, final point of order. I'm just having a quick look at the budget of this film adjusted. I'm just going to quickly find out what that is, because it's always handy to sort of track these things. It cost £40,000 to make, bear in mind, British production. That would be a shade under $2.5 million today. Difficult to really compare because effects houses and different things that make films expensive now, but yeah, so a reasonable budget. Shall we discuss this film sequentially?
Let's try.
I was trying to sort of play the 56 or 54 version in my head, whichever it was. So it's a couple on a trip to Switzerland with their daughter Betty.
Bob, very annoying child.
Yeah. Mind you, I didn't feel much sympathy with the boy in the remake, to be fair, but again, I'll stop going on about that because I haven't seen it for maybe 3 years.
No, I think he's a bit more annoying.
But they're friends with some Frenchman.
I think you just know how old it is when there's a child called Betty.
Called Betty.
Betty.
Agnes, come for dinner. Come for supper, yeah.
It was 1930s, I guess.
Well, yeah. So they're there. And to start with, is it downhill skiing or ski jumping they're watching?
Yeah, probably be a ski jumping or something, wouldn't it? I wonder if it's like the Winter Olympics or something
like
that.
Going fast
I don't
and
know.
Falling off.
Yeah.
It's Eddie the Eagle.
And then he's like, but he's totally fine, even though it looks quite a catastrophic accident. But they're there. She's taking part in a clay pigeon shooting contest. Now, what I don't quite get is, given the relative roles of men and women in society this far back, have they gone all the way to Switzerland for this little contest, or are they just doing this for a laugh while they're on holiday?
Well, it's kind of played that it is. It's just a lot. It's just a bit of fun, you know, like...
Right.
Like, there's no real sort of... I don't think it's any sort of prize. It's all kind of like...
There's no sort of information, really, is there? It's not like, oh, they've gone up for the Winter Olympics or something like that.
But they're dressed in their street clothes while representing Great Britain.
It is a bit Chekhov's gun style-y, because obviously her being a sharpshooter will come into play...
And the watch.
Later on, as time goes on.
Well, and the watch.
This the whole, watch, like, yes. opening bit is just all, like, foreshadowing.
Well,
I'll see you next... You know, it's like, she's literally playing up against the guy that she will shoot.
She's having a clay pigeon shooting contest with a guy called... She reaches the final. It says it's a bit of a tournament. And there's a guy, Ramon, who beats her because she's distracted by a chime in coming from a watch belonging to a guy called Mr. Abbott, who's the Peter Lorre character. That is all foreshadowing. She's an excellent shot. This guy is as well, but she's slightly better, and this guy's got a watch, and that sound will come into play later.
How did you guys watch this film? Like, did you see it on a home release or on YouTube?
I had it saved on YouTube to watch, but then I think Becca mentioned offline it was on Prime Video, so I watched it there.
Yeah, same here.
I saw a couple of different versions. So I watched it, and I've got the release from Network, RIP Network. I don't know if it's my hearing or the sound or what, but I also watched this on Prime and on YouTube. I'm not sure if there are any great differences. I need to look into it. But I noticed that on the Network release, they are amazing. I do miss Network, but I noticed that the chiming doesn't come through as much on that home release particularly. Maybe it's my sound, I don't know.
It wasn't great. What I will say, though, is at one point, maybe 10 minutes into the film, I physically doubted myself because, like I say, saved it on YouTube. And if anyone did this now, if any of you are watching this on YouTube, stick on the auto-generated subtitles and just read how it interprets what we're saying, because it's just funny. It's always hilariously wrong. Say when you watch BBC News live. And I'm used to having subtitles on because I have a Romanian wife. She can speak English perfectly well, but she just thinks she has it in her head that it helps her to learn if she can just follow along with the words on the screen.
Fair enough.
Even though she's, you know, pretty native standard of speaker. And so I'm watching it on Prime, and it's the most hilariously terrible subtitles.
Yeah, the Prime subtitles are awful. Yeah, I would agree. They're absolutely terrible.
I had to check I wasn't watching YouTube by mistake because it looked auto-generated.
I complained. I wonder if they are AI-generated or something, because they are absolutely nonsense. Literally, if audiences, listeners, if you're watching this film on Prime, don't
worry. Stick the subtitles on. Just have a quick look.
They are nonsense. They are absolutely rubbish. Oh my god! I wish I could do them myself because they'd be so much better.
You shouldn't be allowed to release that.
They are terrible subtitles and they make no sense whatsoever. But they're hilarious.
The thing is, as well, subtitles are there as an accessibility thing. Everything should have it now if you can do it. And of course, AI, which is going to destroy an awful lot of jobs, has come in to make it.
I wonder if they are AI generated. Yeah, but they are terrible.
It makes it a substandard product because I watched it pretty much by myself, but my wife was sort of in and out of the room. And a couple of times I pointed it out and I said, just watch this for a minute, right? And she was laughing at it.
Yeah.
And she was like, what does that mean? And I'm like, yeah, it was. Some of it was trying to almost phonetically spell what had just been said. So, not an example I saw, but I remember a history teacher of mine saying years ago that he was marking an essay, and he got to this phrase, and he was like, "What the hell does that mean?" And he looked at it for fully 10 minutes. ORDY space PENDS. It all depends.
He spells it phonetically.
Yeah, it all depends. And, yeah. And that's what the subtitles are like. But yeah, they're really, really bad. I recommend putting them on for 2 minutes, but on a serious point.
God help you if you can understand them.
Serious point, this is meant to be helping people, these subtitles, and they're not fit for purpose. So shame on Amazon Prime.
Amazon Prime, terrible subtitles. Mm. I mean,
whereas Netflix is a perfect every time.
Netflix is great. And likewise, you know, if you can find the network release of the DVD is spot on. I've got some nice extras on there as well, but my only critique of that really would be like the chiming of his watch sound didn't come through as much, but that's probably just my sound system because I've not got a sound system, basically very basic, speakers that come out of my TV.
Yeah, I don't remember, I didn't hear it loud.
But it's something, it's meant to be quite key, but perhaps it didn't come across on one of the versions.
Was there, but you didn't, on the version I watched,
it was bigger loud.
It was one of those things that I didn't realise it had been loud enough to distract her until it was clear she'd missed because of that.
Yeah.
Whereas if the sound mix had been correct, you'd have gone, oh, and you'd have almost gone, oh, right, and jerked yourself. Not jerked yourself, but you know what I mean. So the other key point is they're friends with this Frenchman, Louis, who's also staying at the hotel. And then in the evening, they all go as a family to, like, I don't know if it's a dinner and dance, a ball or what.
It's kind of like a dinner, isn't it? But I think it's quite an intense scene, and you've got a scene with the thread in that as well, so it's quite
The key point here is this is a couple that have been together a very long time and they're ultimately very comfortable with each other. She's not bothered about him dancing. I mean, you shouldn't be bothered about your partner dancing with somebody else innocently enough, but they are making jokes about my wife's gone off with another man,
you dirty dog.
Yeah, completely relaxed about it, and she's got a knitting with her, which is kind of funny. So they go off for
something
dance.
Something like my grandma would have done, probably.
And while they're dancing, he's shot. It's not immediately clear. It's one of those where you feel something.
It's very much like, oh dear,
what a shame.
And they're like, bad luck, you loved him.
Oh dear, you loved him. Oh. There's an amazing shot where, like,
dear,
you see
I
the...
appear to be shot. Oh, how
oh dear,
embarrassing.
I've been shot. There's, like, an amazing scene where, like, you see the bullet go through the glass window. And, like, all these hands point to it and go, oh, look, there's, like, six or eight hands that just point.
But the hilarious thing about this
these days,
is
you just always get the phones out and just start filming.
The wife is...
Precisely, they would.
Again, it's all a bit off in that the wife shows sort of the level of... Not his wife, obviously, not Louis's wife, but Jill, shows the right level of concern and cradling of him. But she seems to show no real shock that the person she was just dancing with has just, like, had a bullet go through him centimetres from her. And the husband seems totally chilled out about it. But the key...
They're all a bit sort of 1930s stiff upper lip, aren't they?
It's almost like I was watching it, I was going, does he know that guy's just been shot?
Well, he does. He sends his daughter straight up, doesn't he? He's like, he knows something...
Yeah, they've got to go. He dies in Jill's arms again. Nothing implied there about romance. She just happens to be dancing with him, and there's a little joke about him being tied up with, you know, the knitting and all the rest of it, which is neither here nor there. And I thought it was more a sign of what a playful couple they were. Really, that's all. Nothing that really plays out in the rest of the film, though, which is a shame. And then she, in the dying, she says to go to his room and find a brush. He means a shaving brush. and there's a note in it.
Yeah, he basically, like, it's that trope. I'm dying, please have my MacGuffin. So that's obviously the thing that the police are interested in, but the audience don't really care. And yeah, there's a bit of paper inside this shaving brush in the bathroom. So.
And it says something about A Hall, which, having A-hole. Seen the remake, wasn't cryptic to me. Yeah, it's a Wapping. I'm a bit confused. The Albert Hall in Wapping, is it?
Oh. Oh, no, that's not. Also, another point about the Amazon subtitles. They spell. Obviously, Wapping is a place in London. It's quite working class. Now it's probably quite gentrified. I don't know because I've not been there. But it's spelled Wapping.
Most famous in this country because the News of the World or News International, Rupert Murdoch moved his operations there, and there was a load of industrial strife off over it. He basically left Fleet Street.
To go to Wapping. Yeah. There we go. But then, like, on the Amazon subtitles, it's spelled like Wapping as in like Wapping Great, like Wapping. Yeah. I found that hilarious.
But you also see different spellings. Like, somebody will say Mrs. Lawrence, and then they'll say it again two sentences later, two completely different spellings.
Yeah, ridiculous. Yeah. I'm pretty sure they're AI generated.
Well, they are. They do. That's why I had to check, because I thought I was on YouTube. As I say, listen to 1 minute of us on YouTube or watch BBC News Live, and you'll get exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, nonsense. Anyway, I just thought I'd draw your attention to the terrible subs. They couldn't discern between Wapping the place and Wapping.
There's a little bit of tension him getting to the room, isn't there? Because whoever it was who killed him is trying to get there first. So there's a bit of tension about that.
Yeah.
But he manages to get there. And yeah, that's what the note says. And then what? Where do they go? There's a couple of scenes missing in my head now.
There's things with the concierge, isn't there?
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot of paperwork, isn't there, I think?
And then Jill gets a note, doesn't it, basically they kidnapped the daughter.
They've kidnapped the daughter and basically
Yeah, we don't really see it happen. It kind of happens off screen.
Which I think is quite...
It looks kind of creepy because it cuts to her and she's kind of looks a bit shocked.
Mm.
And she's just like sort of there, like in close with what's that guy's name? The clay pigeon.
Ramon.
Yeah, it is Ramon, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it just looks very creepy because his hand goes around her mouth and she's just like there, like in shock.
She gets a bit more shocked as the thing goes on. But I think they're both kind of like they're very. Stuff about it British. I mean, there's obviously a scene towards the end where Bob is reunited with Betty, and he's kind of like, oh, come on, you know, your school report was really good. Oh, that's a nice dressing gown you're wearing. You know, stop being so silly. And it's just like...
I mean, I will compare...
Your child, you know.
I will compare when we come to the remake, because, again, I appreciate it's different, but there's still a kidnap in a foreign country of a couple's child.
No, that's it. And, it's a different era. You know, it's 50s.
But it's not just style. It's environment and staging and everything else, because in the remake, they're in a much less controlled environment, which makes them immediately a bit more... It immediately feels a more desperate situation. Whereas here, they're in a sort of almost lockdown hotel. Now, they've got away with the kid, but it all feels much more low-key. They do head... How quickly do they head back to Britain?
They're pretty much straight away. I think
it's very quickly, yeah.
As soon as, like, we know the child's been kidnapped.
Because you hear London and... Da, da, da,
yeah.
Da. To be fair, this film... I mean, it's like...
You see Piccadilly or something like that. It's really nice, yeah.
Yeah, really pretty. Definitely, this film does rattle along. It's quite pacey. Like it does move along
for the most part. Yeah.
Yeah, generally, there are some scenes which do drag, but for the most part, it does wiggle along a little bit.
We take a bit of a time to get to the actual point, but the point is they're going to shoot. Now, this is another thing. I had the subtitles on, and even if you can hear perfectly and speak perfect native English, your eyes keep getting drawn.
The subs still cock it up,
right? Which means. In my head, the guy, and it maybe it is, but the guy they were shooting is called Roper, which makes me think of George Roper from George and Mildred. And he's meant to be a foreign fucking dignitary. There's a foreign dignitary called Roper.
They spell his name R-O-P-A, but even in the subs, they still spell it like R-O-P-E-R.
Yeah, so I'm thinking like George and Mildred, which is for people not from this country, is a 70s fucking sitcom. With a henpecked husband. So, they're going to shoot this guy. whatever he is, maybe Eastern European, something like that, at the Albert Hall at some sort of concert, a little bit like the remake. And it's like they're being warned not to get involved. They're threatening to kill Betty. They're threatening to kill the parents if anyone finds out. So they can't go to the police.
The police are there questioning, like, so where is your daughter?
Yeah, they work out that the A Hall is the Royal Albert Hall. Unfortunately, because I've seen the films the wrong way around, I knew that immediately. Whereas if you were coming to this fresh, you might think that's a person's name that they have to go.
Yeah, you wouldn't know.
Yeah. And how do they, the bit I missed, because I've seen this once, how did they end up realizing they had to go to a sun worshipping cult? Because suddenly they were going there.
Oh, it's a dentist, wasn't it, as well?
Right. I've got to add one bit, sorry. Husband and wife get a bit separated at one point. The wife is talking to what I thought was a brother. I think it's a family friend or something, but he's referred to by Betty as Uncle Clive. He's basically a family friend because they're talking about he bought the kid a train set and she didn't like it or played with it. But they said that to her. They have such a friendly, open rapport with each other that they can say that. Oh, did she like the train set I bought? Nah, she doesn't play with it.
No, that's a little bit too open, but yeah, it seems quite... quite easygoing in that regard. The film kind of like leaves the wife, and then almost exclusively we do sort of follow Clive and Bob.
Bob. Clive's like the comedic foil, really, in this.
Yeah, Clive's like the comic relief.
Yeah, and as I say, we'll get to the sequence in a minute. But how do we go from them getting back to working out from the note that they need to go to this sun worshipping place? Is it because of the dentist?
I think it is.
I think it's right.
Can somebody clue me in here, because I must have missed something?
So they've had like the chap who was working with, is it Lewis, the guy from the British intelligence, and he stays.
And
he seems to sort of already know what's going on.
It turns out the Frenchman, that was it. They tell him that the Frenchman was actually working with British Secret Service.
Mm. Yeah.
Whether that means he was British and undercover as a Frenchman or whether he was a Frenchman co-opted, we're not sure. But they were uncovering this plot.
Yeah. And he very untactly tries to sort of like, well, come on, tell us what you know.
You're right.
You know, it's like, yeah, you know, your daughter might already be dead anyway, so you might as well just, you know...
Right, okay. Now, that's Gibson they're talking to, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, I get it. So
Gibson's the agent who's basically kind of like fills them in all the information and says, oh, like, basically...
Yeah, and they don't have to go to the police for that, do they? Because they know that they met Louis and Louis's dead and they know what Louis did.
They
so...
get a phone call, don't they?
Yeah, a phone call saying, yeah, dude, your child has been kidnapped. No, don't mention anything.
Right. The bit I haven't got straight in my mind is I remember Gibson telling them this, but at some point they go to a dentist and they go to the sun worshipping cult. Which way round is that and how did that happen?
We don't know.
If we don't know, we'll move on. So they go to see some dentist who's got information. God, anyone who does like other Hitchcock pods is now screaming at their machine going, what the fuck? They haven't followed this film at all.
I've seen this film so many times. I think because of the way it does kind of move around as well, and also a lot of it does kind of get lost a little bit in the editing. I mean, it is kind of some aspects are disjointed a little bit. I mean, it's like the very first opening scenes of this film. Obviously there is a skiing accident, but obviously the film was still very much in its infancy. Even the way it's kind of put together, like there's a quote which I'll give you at the end when we do the fun facts, from Hitchcock about his making of this film and attitudes towards this in the remake, for example. But I think that the way it's kind of put together is sort of quite hastily kind of chopped together and could have been done a bit better. But then it was 1934, so that's fine. But I think a lot of it is kind of just lost up. You just have to kind of go with it. A lot of it doesn't make a lot of sense.
So for reasons, they find out they've got to. I think Whopping may be the dentist.
Because
I'm
reasons.
Sure.
Well, yeah, the note that they find inside the brush, there is a name of the dentist business. So they just
obviously that's it. Yes. So they know to go there, and having gone there, basically he manages to get. They pretend to have tooth problems, and eventually they end up knocking out the dentist with gas and air. And while he's under, Bob poses as the dentist, pretending to be working on him as Abbott comes in with Ramon, and they explain what they know.
He's a dodgy dentist. There are no other types. There is an evil dentist.
Yeah.
Is it safe? Yeah.
Yeah. So safe? I didn't think of that actually. I thought that's a, for those who don't know, that's a Marathon Man reference, the Dustin Hoffman film with Laurence Olivier from the 70s. Really good film.
It's a good job I'm not a dentist, because I'll be tempted to say that every time they step into the chair.
Literally, we're not aware of.
If you get someone of the wrong age, you know, maybe 60 now, they've run out screaming because, like, the first film that ever frightened them was Marathon Man. But yeah, so they end up knowing that they've got to go to the Albert Hall to try to sort of. But Bessie, I think, knows this. Oh, that's it. They end up. They're told that if Betty goes there, or if they involve themselves in any way, and he calls home and says what's happening, and it's the Albert Hall, she heads off there. But just after she's left, the criminals call her. The woman from the sun worshipping cult calls her to warn her off, but she's already left. The sun worshipping cult thing. This was where I kind of thought, am I watching a comedy or am I watching Gross Incompetence? Because Clive gets hypnotized by them in about 8 seconds. A very deep hypnosis as well. The reaction shot of her from his perspective is what I was referring to when I was talking about the fly, the slowly fading out image. But then they have a fight throwing chairs at each other. And I was laughing my ass off at this, but not sure if it was meant to be funny or just they had no idea how to do action. And because there's a final shootout, which is fairly incompetent as well, I thought, well, maybe this is just shit. I don't know. But this
it's
is all
a bit kind of hastily put together, isn't it? But I think it's quite. There are some quite good lines, like before this, like before he gets hypnotized or anything. Obviously, they sit at the back, and before they go into the actual sun worshipping cult, there's a funny line where Bob goes, "Oh, maybe they haven't got any clothes on," and it's like, "Oh," like a cheeky laugh.
It's kind of funny how like they're trying to like have a conversation while singing a hymn.
Yeah, literally, that was my next
over
point.
Over there.
Clive.
That's trouble. That was genuinely funny when they're trying to sing. They've got one book between them. They're not quite sure what they're singing and they're just making up any old shit. It was a bit Enrico Palazzo.
They have to kind of get across information somehow, and how are they going to do it through singing this hymn? Even when, you know, they're going to get found out momentarily. So
anyway, they end up needing to go to the... Well, she goes to the Albert Hall. She spots the gunman, she spots the dignitary, and the only way she can stop it is to just scream and distract him. So the guy ends up getting a flesh wound, but to the viewer, us, it's not immediately obvious because he does slump over. And it's not until Peter Lorre, I think, is listening to the radio, because this concert is broadcast live on radio.
Yep.
So they're listening to it and they realise it cuts to the news that it's a flesh wound, he's not been killed.
It's a flesh wound, multi-python.
Yeah. And so they realise that something's afoot. And for reasons, we end up in a big gunfight now. He's made all the women working with him in this cult stay. And they're all basically locked in as the police sort of find out what have gone on. And they've gone there to try to... I think he's gone there to try and get his daughter back. And the police have gone there to try to... sort of catch the people responsible for shooting Roper.
I bet those police officers are like kind of kicking themselves like... after like arresting Clive after he tried
Obviously Betty's kind of like being held prisoner next door, so they've gone there to try and search her and that as well. I think that a chair fight is quite hilarious. Like, I don't think I've seen a chair fight before or since in movies,
but it's a bit like a throwing technique he's got.
Yeah,
not,
quite
not
good,
really. It looks
definitely.
Like toddlers throwing stuff at each other.
there's probably a way to, you know, probably a way to do it in terms of the stunt work. I'm not quite sure. But what amazes me, like, all that you hear, like, Bob's kind of making a lot of grunting as he throws his chair. As he's kind of like, you know, makes a lot of grunting noises as he throws as his chairs are being thrown. But they appear to be like, I mean, I don't know what they're made out of. Really, like soft wood. But it's like those breakaway stunt chairs, because they shatter so easily and
they fall apart really easily.
Yeah, there's probably not MDF, but probably like really soft wood. Like as if you ever go behind the scenes and do a tour at like Warner Brothers or Universal or something like that, for example, they'll give you an example of like sugar glass, or like really soft material that looks a lot harder than what it is. I mean, there's a famous video of Charles and Diana going to a movie studio, and I think she breaks a glass across her head, but obviously it's made of sugar glass, so it's quite soft. But just to give an example of a very old example, but it's like that. Literally, they'll just kind of they are just.
I'm pretty sure that was the Cadbury Broccoli stage. I think that
it
was
probably
around
was,
the time
yeah,
of,
it was
Living
exactly.
Living Daylights was being shot.
Probably Daylights or
It was the Living Daylights.
Definitely.
Anyone who
it's,
knows
it's a bit
that,
like that, isn't it? They're obviously really breakaway
chair. And this is where the film just slightly outstays its welcome, and I only mean slightly. And I think that's having the remake in my head, just that it goes on to this shootout where it looks like kids playing with toy guns. It just, none of it looks particularly real. It takes a very long time. There is some tension. He's trying to get his daughter out, and they sort of end up, she ends up on the roof with Ramon.
Yeah, quite a funny chase.
As he's about to shoot, and the criminals end up sort of getting picked off one by one through windows and that from police fire. As Ramon's about to shoot, Jill grabs the shotgun from one of the police officers and takes him out, which was foreshadowed at the start of the film. So he's killed before young Betty could be killed. And then the police storm inside, and it is not clear to me whether they shoot Abbott through the door or Abbott shoots himself as they're about to shoot at him through the door.
No, you hear like the chiming of his clock again, of his watch again.
That's what sets him off.
That's what gives him away.
The watch from the start of the film, that's effectively written, really.
I wonder if he shoots himself. Again, it's not clear. It's probably deliberately or not, you know, ambiguous.
A plot synopsis will tell you he did. But again, that's edited by people. I suspect he probably did, but they did have a good fire.
Yeah, it's one of those did he, didn't he sort of thing.
And the family are reunited and happy days.
And live happily ever after. This is it.
I was quite surprised how actual violent the whole climax was. Like, there's a
lot
of, like...
Well, it is. It's quite an epic shootout, isn't it?
There's quite a lot of, like, sort of just, like, you know, random police just shot. Like,
you do see a little bit of blood as well, like, ever so slightly.
There is some blood, and there's quite a heavy... body count.
And, yeah,
yes,
and even
is.
The
and considering it's got like a U certificate or maybe a PG at most. I mean, obviously it's not
the gunplay doesn't look particularly, I say, no. Realistic. I've never watched it in real life, but it doesn't look particularly what we think of as film realistic.
No, but probably back then it was, you know, probably cutting edge. And it's a precursor to kind of sort of like gunfights, like for example, as you've seen when we did the spaghetti western series, for example.
Absolutely. So that's it, the first version of The Man Who Knew Too Much. Just some final thoughts for me. A bit of a mixed bag, really. I think I can only reiterate what I said before. I think we're now a handful of years from an iteration of in film, or a time in film history, that I suddenly get very, very comfortable with. And I've seen hundreds of examples, and I don't judge it up against today's cinema, but I don't overcompensate and judge it as though they've only just picked up a camera for the first time. Here, I never know how experienced can you get from the dawn of cinema. How experienced are you 7-8 years on from talkies being introduced? You know, what techniques do they know? What sort of effects, so to speak, or stunt play can they do? And it's just something I don't know. But then we come on 7-8 years from this, and we'll get into an era where I've just seen so many of them, I know what to expect. But for what it is, it's fine. Unfortunately, I saw the remake first, and although I'm not in love with that, it has some lovely elements to it that were sort of missing here. But it hangs together quite well. And whilst I'm glad films aren't 75 minutes now, because it is too short, in the infancy of film where they don't have some of the nuance they've got now, it was enough, really. That's it from me.
Yeah, I'm kind of similar. I quite enjoyed it. I think there's a little uneven tone for what I'm used to, but generally speaking, I quite liked it. I quite liked the performances. I particularly liked Peter Lorre's villain. I also liked little sort of smatterings of. I did like some of the humor. It just took me by surprise. Like particularly the. At the end, you got all this like kind of shooting going on, and you got a postman going like, "Well, I've still got a delivery to do, so yeah." All this kind of like odd little sort of side bits. You're thinking, like, "Okay, well, that's wasn't expecting that, but you know, here we are." But yeah, no,
they haven't quite worked out yet, have they, what's relevant and what's relevant. It's like last week where we were far further back in terms of the history of talkies, because a lot of difference between a year or two in and 7 or 8 years in. But you know, when they were just putting everything was explained, shall we go out to the pub now, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, well, no, just put them in the pub and show us that and we'll work it out. And I think that that's where we're seeing the sort of, you know, how youthful this art form still is.
But yeah, no, I think we're sort of, yeah, it's nice seeing a film like Hitchcock kind of grow as cinema grows.
Yeah, and off the top of my head, I can't imagine there were many examples of filmmakers like that, because he was still active in the mid-70s. You know, you do get Howard Hawks and Billy Wilder and other people like that working through maybe parts of the first half of the century where you go, yeah, but it was finite. He was still recording. His last film came out the year I was born. And his first film came out before they'd even invented sound in film. So, yeah, I think that's a good point. But you will also see him become slightly passé at the very end, because he's still making films years after things like Mean Streets have come out.
That's it. Yeah, I'm sure there are other filmmakers. I mean, obviously he's a contemporary of obviously Michael Powell, who would be hugely famous for his connection with Eric.
Well, Kurosawa's last film was something like 85, to be
well,
fair.
Well, yeah, he had a very long career as well, and he was working kind of right through the infancy of cinema, yeah, right the way through.
Ran was 1985. I take it back. Kurosawa, definitely.
That's another example as well. You know, people working literally right through for the, well, not for the infancy of cinema, but like the very, very early days of sound, sort of colour, and then right the way through up until like maybe 70s, 80s, 90s.
Anything else we want to add on this? Becca, you got any sort of final thoughts on it? Because obviously you sort of introduced us to it tonight as something to look at.
Yes. Well, I hope it hasn't been a wasted journey. You know, I hope you've managed to enjoy it. I mean, at least it's one of those things whereby, like, if there's a remake, we're probably going to check out the original. And it's one of those ones where, yes, the original was quite early, but I mean, you've kind of got like Peter Lorre, who's a big name. Obviously, Hitchcock is kind of a big name as well. I mean, the remake is probably like middle of the table for me when it comes to Hitchcock, definitely. But I'm a huge fan of Jimmy Stewart, huge fan of Doris Day.
Can we do a rankings episode when we don't do every film we did?
I can give you my top five now.
Of the ones I've seen with Jimmy Stewart in, and I'm not sure if that's all of them, I think it is, it's my least favourite.
Yeah, it would probably be down there somewhere as well.
But it's still good. It's still the era.
Oh yeah, for sure.
For me.
Yeah, I think ranking, it was the same as Bond, for example. Like it does change quite a lot. I mean, there's sort of pros and cons to both, really. I mean, there are aspects of this which I prefer, and there are aspects of the remake which I prefer. Aspects of this which I'm not so keen on, and aspects of the remake
There's a bit of melodrama in the remake.
It's more melodramatic. Like for example, in this film. Like Bob, the Bob character isn't so educated, whereas like Jimmy Stewart is. He's probably the more educated of the two. Here in this film, I feel like certainly in the 30s and 40s, like women have a lot more agency, whereas perhaps not so much later on. Certainly in terms of the remake, unfortunately.
Of cultural conservatism.
It might be. It totally might be as well.
Certainly, the second one's American as well.
Well, exactly. Yeah, you've got American aspects of it as well, and kind of the roles of women. And that comes along, like, for example, like the women characters are generally sort of quite passive. Whereas,
well,
I've got
a theory. That makes it, that implies I've been working on it for a while, but we're in the interwar years here. And if you, certainly in the Second World War, men went away to war. I think we had conscription in the First World War, so it would have been the same.
Yeah, women, so you got the women stepping in and doing the men's roles.
You got women doing men's roles, working in munitions factories and things like that. America, in both cases, I don't know that they had conscription in either of the world wars, and whatever they did, they weren't under attack on their own soil to quite the same degree, let's put it that way.
No.
So I don't know if it had the same effect on the female gender as it did here.
That's a good question, actually. Yeah, that's
really
something.
It could just be an idea. It's more or less off the top of my head. Whereas when you watch a traditional 1950s film, that's American. Women are much more the domestic homemaker than British women in a 1930s equivalent.
Well, that's the general way things were, wasn't it? Pretty much. Obviously, women kind of generally, certainly over here in the UK, stepped in to fill the men's roles as they were off fighting in the war. And then, obviously, kind of things come forward. All the men come home, and it's back in the kitchen with you.
Yeah. Do us a sandwich, love. I've just been fighting.
That's a sweeping statement, but just kind of get about that. Generally, in the films, you know, there are kind of more. I mean, you do kind of get that sort of these 70s and 80s. I mean, for example, like, just to give you another example of Psycho, for example, the women characters are perhaps the strongest. The men do take the back seat. Certainly when you come to Frenzy, for example, I mean, none of the characters come out of that particularly well. The strongest character is probably his wife. You know, she's got her own business, she's got her own house, she's got her own club. She unfortunately is killed off. But again, you know,
I was going to say, I've not seen some of these films. I'll forget by then.
And a film that's full of terrible people. You know, it's the women that come out the strongest, unfortunately. Yeah, if you'll listen to me waffling on for another couple of minutes. Actually, you mentioned the war. Just to give you another bit of information, on the network release of this, there's a really fab intro by film theorist Charles Barr. I think he's still going. He says that this is a real homecoming for Hitchcock, for example. His previous films were through a company called British International, whereas now, for this film, he's working under Michael Balcon, quite famous filmmaker.
What do I know him from?
BAFTA gives him award, Michael Balcon award.
Yeah, but what do I know the name from? I'm having a weird blank. I'll look it up, don't worry. Yeah, it'll be something really obvious. It's a bit like saying, what do you know Howard Hawks from? It's like, I'm just blanking. I will look and see what it is specifically I'm thinking of.
Producer. Let's have a look.
I'm doing it, it's all right.
Roger, 39 Steps, we'll come across. You've got connection to Ealing as well.
Daniel Day-Lewis is his grandson.
There we go. Probably, that's the outstanding contribution is named after him. So it's just a very well-known...
It's called Granddad. It's Ealing.
Ealing connection, definitely. Yeah. But he's got association with Hitchcock as well.
The Lady Killers. I know exactly what it is. Kind Hearts and Coronets, etc.
Yeah, with a bit of Ealing, so that would be cool. If we could do an Ealing series, that'd be amazing.
Yes! Stick it on the list, yes. I did a review, set the tape about 3 years ago now, so a fair while, of the Lady Killers home release. Really enjoyed it, and I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I love that release. That
it's another one of my blind spots. I did it because I hadn't seen it. And I'd seen the crap Tom Hanks remake, and crap with a capital C.
Yeah, that was rubbish.
I actually quite enjoyed the Coen Brothers Lady Killers when I first watched it.
Yeah, I mean, okay. Well, fair enough. My point is, I got this pristine like restoration of it with a load of lovely extras for free to review.
It was nice,
and I was really, really charmed by it. Gave it a stunning review, and I thought, and it is one of my blind spots. I've watched relatively little Ealing. I have a feeling, I have a feeling I've probably seen more than I think I have, and I'd watch bits and go, oh, I remember this. But I don't, off the top of my head, know much Ealing. But yeah, that's what I know Michael Balcon from.
Again, it's kind of like those big ones, isn't it? Like, you'd have seen like the Lady Killers. You'd have seen, Kind Hearts and Coronets.
I'm not sure if I've seen Kind Hearts and Coronets. This is 15 years ago now, but I wasn't sure if I'd seen Doctor Strangelove, and then I put it on and recognised it immediately.
Yeah. I didn't hear it. It's the war room. Just to go back. So obviously Hitchcock at this time was working under Michael Balcon. And Charles Barr says this is more... Yeah, it's a homecoming for Hitchcock, definitely. The crime thriller is more of a recognisable Hitchcock genre, whereas previous films were not so much. He worked across a variety of genres prior to this, but they were arguably not as successful. So the next six films he'd make... including the 39 Steps and The Lady Vanishes, could also be seen as within this genre again. And we'll go on to gain Hitchcock worldwide
recognition. I'm really looking forward to The Lady Vanishes because it's one of those I think I've seen, think I loved, but I'm not convinced. It might just be pop culture's, you know, dripped into my head on it.
That's it, yeah. They all kind of, for me, films of this era do kind of blend into one a little bit. So
I seem to remember it, some elderly woman goes missing. Well, the clue's in the title, but I feel like I've seen the film.
But again, there have been lots of different remakes, iterations, versions, plays, small screen, big screen. It's a well-worn tale. So let's have a look, what else does he say? Yeah, so obviously Charles Bennett wrote the film. He would go on to write the next four Hitchcock movies. Hitchcock said that he preferred working with playwrights rather than authors or writers, as they were used to, as Hitchcock put it, the building of successive climaxes, in quotation marks.
I've seen loads of films like that.
Yes, successive climaxes. Barr argues that Bennett created the template of Hitchcock thriller, which is almost a sub-genre in its own right. Fast-moving thrills, romance, comedy, psychological complexity, which I couldn't say earlier, and dramatic disruption, and culminating in the formation or reformation of a romantic couple. Dave, you mentioned the war. Don't mention the war. Did it once, got away with it. Obviously, this film was made in 1934. Europe is very newly tense. We're on the edge here. Recent events include the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, obviously inspired the kidnapping of Betty. Obviously, Hitler becomes Chancellor in the mid-1930s. World War II is not too far away, so maybe 4 or 5 years away.
That's an odd concept to sort of think about, isn't it? And, you know, you're thinking, like, actually, you know, we're watching something that is pre-World War II, which is...
But not far away at all.
But then, you know, we instantly just don't think of that, do we?
No, exactly. You've got these world events are kind of featuring upon these things as well. I mean, when you come to sort of the films of like the 50s and 60s, social mores and attitudes are kind of informing on it as well.
But they're as close to World War II as we are to not 2019. It's very close now.
This is it. Yeah, we're edging closer. I mean, like,
and you're going to get the build up over the next few years with the Sudeten and London, all that. It's all exactly.
I mean, there's a scene in the next film, 39 Steps, where Honey has to give an impromptu speech, and he's kind of advocating peace when a lot of people actually would have been clamouring for war. So it was quite unusual in that regard. And again, you've got kind of like a very pre-war kind of almost informing upon that. Anyway, yeah, Barr's final point was that Hitchcock continues to create innovative camera techniques and spectacular set pieces. So, like, for example, another trope would be how he has a finale at like a landmark or, you know, a key setting. Obviously, here
That's huge for Hitchcock.
Well, it really is. For example, I mean,
by any means.
No, I mean, like, for example, we'll have Royal Albert Hall, Mount Rushmore. Yeah, the list goes on. There's quite a few big places. Like, we went to go and see Strangers on a Train at the cinema, even though that's, you know, that just climaxes a fair, but it's like it's a really elaborate set piece on this carousel, on this merry-go-round that so disintegrates and explodes to an explosive finish. But again, it's, you know, so it becomes a real trope. So this kind of shootout that we have at the Royal Albert Hall is becomes a proper Hitchcock trope, for example. What else have I got to bore you with?
I was going to say, we're basically in fun facts now, aren't we?
We are, pretty much. I can do some fun facts if you want.
Well, you're kind of doing them, but obviously Chris won't fully appreciate the film because he needs to know that he's learning fun facts.
No, this is it. Well, I'll just go through some tropes, and then because this is the film, he knew too much.
All right.
So we've got the tropes. Obviously, Hitchcock Bond, which is Edna Best and later Nova Pilbeam. The Wrong Man, which is the lead character. The titular character is a skier who dies. Obviously, you've got the Hitchcock cameo. After the dentist scene, Hitchcock is seen crossing over the road and he's wearing a shiny black raincoat. You sort of blink and you miss him. It's a very quick scene. Stairs is another Hitchcock trope. Don't really see him a lot in this film, but the two leads ascend a staircase. In the final scene, Betty escapes via skylight staircase onto the roof. As I just mentioned, the dramatic finale, iconic landmark is Royal Albert Hall. Animals or birds, obviously there's a dog at the start of this film, but that's about it. That's pretty much it. No dogs were shot in the making of this film, quite luckily. So I'll just go on and do some fun facts. The film's called Man Who Knew Too Much. It would help to know a bit much about this film. I'll probably just repeat. Writer Charles Bennett wrote quite a few Hitchcock films. Blackmail, he wrote this film. 39 Steps, Secret
he wrote,
Agent.
He
which
wrote the
covering.
Book. Well, he wrote the book, didn't he? He was.
He did, but I don't. I think the book is unrelated in this regard.
No, no, not this book. I mean, did you refer to him as a previous as a playwright?
Oh, yeah, he wrote for Black Belt. Yes, he did. Yeah, that's Sorry. Right. Yeah, that's correct. He'd also go on to write Sabotage, Young and Innocent, of Horror Correspondent, which I'm not going. I don't think I'll cover Foreign Correspondent, so apologies for that one. Fun fact number two: this was Peter Lorre's second English language film. They did a multi-language version of M. But obviously, at the time, he couldn't speak English, so he learnt all his lines phonetically. Did quite a good job, actually. I was quite surprised. Fun fact number three: obviously, this film starts off in Switzerland, at St. Moritz. The opening in St. Moritz inspired Hitchcock and Alma to holiday there frequently. They spent their honeymoon there in 1927, so it's a nice location. Fun fact number four, Nova Pilbeam, who played Betty, she passed away in 2015, which is very sad. And
she was 95, 96? I think she was born in 1919, so she was either 95 or 96, depending on...
She was approaching that mark, but until then, yeah, she was the last surviving cast member of this film. And then finally, fun fact number five. I just struggled to find some facts about this movie. The cast had quite made up of regulars who would later go on to appear in other Hitchcock movies. Leslie Banks we'll see again in Jamaica Inn. Peter Lorre will pop up in Secret Agent, which we won't be covering. There's also a Bond connection as he went on to play Le Chiffre in the Climax version of Casino Royale. Nova Pilbeam pops up again in Young and Innocent.
We mean the Climax 1954 TV show.
Not
go looking at Peter Sellers.
Not
he was
the,
dead by then.
Orson Welles.
Yeah,
version.
Orson Welles was Le Chiffre in that one.
No, that's it. Frank Vosper appears in Waltzes from Vienna, which we don't cover. And Michael Wilding, which also appears in Under Capricorn, A Stage Fright, which sadly we won't be covering. There's also a Paul and Pressburger connection, which we'll cover later on in the series, as Banks appeared in A Small Back Room and a minor role. And he and Voss would also appear in an early Michael Powell film, which he made on his own, Red Ensign. So that's my boring fab facts.
No, fab facts is Jerry Ants and your
fun facts. It's fun facts.
You don't even know your own brand.
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I found them fun anyway. And,
found them fun and fun.
And I'm actually loving how much you're loving this. I'm enjoying the films. I'm enjoying watching them. But, like, I can feel your enthusiasm for it, which is absolutely brilliant. I remember when we covered Rocky and I'm off in 15 different directions on, like, boxing stories. And then, you know, during Superman, I knew so much of the making of those films. And you do find yourself going all over the place because you've got so much to say about it. So it's really great.
We do. It's struggling, isn't it? Especially because... I really enjoyed those series as well. Well, I enjoy all the series that we do because you guys are so knowledgeable. Like I learned so much from you, Dave, and from you, Chris, definitely about sort of like production, about the history of these films. I mean, there's some stuff like obviously we're all big Bond fans and we'll kind of know a bit about Bond. Like Dave, you know quite a lot about obviously Rocky, about the sporty movies, things like that as well. Chris, you're a big, you know, self-professed action junkie. You know a lot about the production of these movies as well. So I think there's all going to be a series that perhaps some we
yeah,
didn't
I mean,
know
I,
about
I, I did it, with, I did it
about.
With The Godfather as well, and we've all
exactly,
got
yeah, that was amazing.
But
some of the films that we cover as well, I mean, there's as much going on behind the scenes as there are in the movie. You know, that's often got a fascinating production history.
And in this case, I think I know what's next because I was chatting to Becca just before the show. But as we're going through, I don't have a fixed. Like, there was a period with Marvel where I knew the running order of them all, so I knew what was next, and I didn't even have to think about it. With these, like, half the time, I don't know what's next anyway. And it's great because, you know, one night of the week, you go, I'll have a look at that now, and I've got very little idea what I'm going to get at this stage of the series, which is great. But anyway, as for social media, you can find me at ThePastyKid1976 on Twitter.
You can find me at Cinematrix. You can find all the old episodes on Podbean. Just scroll down and find them.
Or up, if you're already at the bottom.
Oh, yeah.
Scroll back
wherever.
Up again.
Or if you're in the middle, or just scroll in either direction. Depending
I mean,
on
well, let's face it, everyone's just going to Google it, aren't they? I mean...
Yeah. Well, go to, like... I listen to all Spotify anyway to most of our podcasts. But, yeah, our home is Podbean.
Yes, wherever you're listening to us, you can support us in any one of many ways. You can listen to us. Thank you very much for doing that. You can subscribe and... leave us a 5-star review on whichever platform you're listening to us. Don't forget to rate, review, to like and share on your podcatcher of choice. You can find us at Do You Expect Us to Talk on Facebook, Do You Expect Us to Talk, on Twitter, X, at Expect Us to Talk. We're on YouTube, Do You Expect Us to Talk. You're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, Podbay, just wherever you are. Just type in Do You Expect Us to Talk and we'll magically appear. So yeah, if you could kindly subscribe, that'd be lovely. Thank you so much.
Okay. I can't wait. We're starting to get to the more famous stuff, and I think I know what's next, and I can't wait. Becca.
Do You Expect Us to Talk? We'll return with the 39-step